From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. If you've ever responded to a government action by saying, "That doesn't make sense," you're not alone. An author and good government activist explains how he's trying to inject some common sense into our everyday political debates. Some North Carolina legislators want to strengthen gang laws. You'll learn how. You'll also hear some pushback. Another bill in the General Assembly targets those fake phone numbers that are tied to scam artists and telemarketers. You'll learn how lawmakers want to fight that problem. Plus, we'll learn about the growing interest in dental therapy. How could it increase healthcare access and lower costs? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Kim Strack served the North Carolina Board of Elections for nearly two decades, with the last 6 years in the role of executive director. But despite bipartisan praise for her work, on May 13th, Strack was replaced. Governor Roy Cooper has said that he never had any conversation about getting rid of Kim Strack, but leading legislative Republicans are questioning the governor's potential role in what has occurred here. Carolina Journal has been following this story. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief, and he joins me now with an update. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
Was Kim Strack fired because she's not a Democrat and Roy Cooper is?
Yeah.
Very simple. Well, thanks for listening, folks.
Yes, that's the case, because the board has the ability to hire and fire whoever it wants to serve on the staff of the board or the management of the board. And Kim Strack was removed because the board wanted to get another Democrat there. I mean, it's pretty clear that the backstory here, it looks as if the individual members of the board on the Democratic side, the 3-2 majority of Democrats, met separately with the new executive director, who's Karen Brinson Bell, and made sure they didn't evade open meetings laws, or didn't violate them by meeting as individuals with her, and not enough to form a quorum where they would actually have to convene the entire board. So the Republicans never actually met Ms. Brinson Bell before she was hired.
Now, the Democrats control the Board
That's
of
right.
Elections. It's
That's
a 3-2 situation.
That's
three
right.
Democrats, two Republicans, and the whole makeup of the board is a whole story in and of itself.
Right. Right. But the Republicans there basically said, we weren't expecting this. We're kind of blindsided. We still have two special congressional elections in play right now. So the timing of this was more than a little suspicious.
The fascinating thing about this is that she has received praise from Republicans, from Democrats, about the quality of her work, her mm-hmm. expertise, and her ability to really do things without political partisanship, including being involved in this District 9 race, which ended up with the Republican who appeared to have won the race on election night, Mark Harris, not being certified. So is it just simply that the Democrats who now control the governor's office just simply wanted a member of their party?
Yeah, and there was also some pushback as well, because during the various iterations of the board that took place over several years that we've discussed earlier on the show, about the way that the board was reconfigured in different ways and then struck down by courts and then reconfigured other ways, one of the provisions that was particularly galling for the governor and for other Democrats was the fact that the law that created many of the versions of the election board said that the current executive director is going to stay in place for a period of time. So basically, the new board would not be able to appoint its own permanent staff leader. And so that really stuck in the governor's craw, and it really irritated Democrats a lot. And so I think that's one thing that made it pop, that made this almost inevitable as early as the board thought it could get away with it. And as early as the board thought it could get away with it, it was just as soon as the 9th district primary was over and things were done with there.
Some of the things that were said in reaction to the departure of Kim Strack. We're really curious. There were some Democrats who said, well, you know, her husband does work for the Republicans, and therefore, you know, maybe she ought not to be there. In this day and age, Rick, one has to wonder about the validity of a comment that a professional woman should be judged by what her husband does for a living.
Yeah, that was rather disturbing. And Wayne Goodwin, the state Democratic Party executive chairman, was particularly outspoken about that and defended his remarks. And again, that was unseemly. And I guess the other issue, of course, is that in a place like Raleigh that's so dominated by politics, it's very difficult for couples who have working spouses, not both to be involved in something related to the business of government. And so the fact that that Kim Strack would be judged in that way, especially if you look at her body of work, she has been at this, as you said, for nearly two decades, started as an investigator with the board, her investigations were integral in getting criminal charge referrals for Meg Scott Phipps, the former agriculture commissioner, for Jim Black, the former House Speaker, for Frank Ballance, former congressman, Mike Easley, of course, the governor, and then even for Republicans like Fletcher Hartzell, the senator from the Cabarrus County area, who was charged with campaign finance violations, and also overseeing this 9th district mess, which very easily could have been certified and could have been kicked up to Washington.
Which is why, as we've mentioned, she has had praise from both sides of the political aisle for not really getting involved in partisanship, just doing investigations and letting the facts take her to whatever the appropriate action was. Regardless, Kim Strack is out. Right. Who's her replacement?
Her replacement is Karen Brinson Bell. She's from Charleston, South Carolina. She's someone who worked for another figure familiar to North Carolina political junkies. That's Gary Bartlett, who was Kim Strack's predecessor at the State Board of Elections as the executive director. The group she worked for is a group called Ranked Choice Voting Resources Center. And this is an organization that advocates for things like instant recall voting, for people to state preferences when they vote in a primary, who's your first choice, who's your second choice, who's your third choice, and having the totals weighted in some way or another. But anyway, apparently Mr. Bartlett was approached about possibly coming back, and he said no. But he said my deputy would be appropriate for the job, and so she is now the executive director of the Elections Board.
Now, there had been questions raised about whether or not Governor Roy Cooper played some role in either requesting that people get rid of Kim Strack or that he essentially said, I want her gone. Now, the governor has said that is not the case, that he hasn't had any conversations about that, but legislative leaders are pushing back on that.
Well, it's quite possible he didn't actually go up to the Democrats in the Board of Elections and say, get her out of here. But it's also quite possible that through surrogates, the same message was delivered, or the message was delivered in a very subtle way by the governor or by those around him. It's pretty clear that this election cycle is going to be, again, another highly politicized one, that it's going to go just beyond raw partisanship and is going to get into some nastiness. And the whole role of the Board of Elections in the battle between the legislature and the governor over separation of powers is something that has been a big annoyance for the governor from before the time he was actually sworn into office. And so I'm sure getting what he considers to be a clean slate at the Board of Elections was really important for him.
We should also say that after the departure of Kim Strack, the general counsel for the Board of Elections also just abruptly resigned. What do we know about that?
Very little. He issued a very short letter of resignation, was appreciative of his time to serve.
Talking about Josh Lawson.
Josh Lawson, who was the spokesman for the board for a while there as well. And he departed somewhat surprisingly. And as of now, the board has not picked a successor. His chief deputy, Caitlin Love, who's been there for a while, is going to be the acting general counsel until a new one's appointed.
So we will see going forward exactly what the new leadership of the State Board of Elections may bring as many, many elections around the corner, all sorts of consequential races. And of course, you can read all the reporting about this and those election races as well at CarolinaJournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who's editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you've ever read or heard about a government action and said to yourself, that just doesn't make sense, you might like this next conversation. Our guest, Philip Howard, wrote the 1995 book, The Death of Common Sense. He's also founder and chairman of the group Common Good, and he's now written a book titled Try Common Sense. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
So I understand this latest book really does focus on government being broken because there's not enough common sense in many ways.
Well, it's because we made common sense illegal. And so I propose a new governing vision that gives back to people the freedom to use their judgment, including in public choices, and to be accountable for how they do.
I understand that part of this is basically a reset of how government works. How so?
Yeah, so what's happened is that over the last 50 years, the bureaucracy has grown in ways that nobody ever really intended. At this point, it's in federal law alone, it's 150 million words. No one can know it. No small businessman can know all the rules that apply to him and such. And it's literally impenetrable. Even the people in government don't have the authority to give a permit. I mean, in the crisis in 2009, President Obama got $800 billion from Congress to stimulate the economy, including to rebuild broken infrastructure. And he could spend almost none of it because he didn't have the authority to give a permit. It would take 5 or 10 years to give a permit to do what everybody knew was obvious.
So if we have to do this reset, what's the first thing we do?
Well, I mean, ultimately, what's needed in this situation, because Congress is hopeless, but frankly, most legislative bodies can't sit there with hundreds of people and say, gosh, how would worker safety work better or something, you know? So the way this always works is you appoint a small recodification commission and a small group of experts, that's what happened with the Uniform Commercial Code in this country in the 1950s, come up with a plan and then it gets approved or not or modified by Congress. But a small group comes up with a plan that basically tries to correct for 50 years of mistakes in each area of law.
And from what I understand, part of what the correction would involve would be allowing people who are in government to actually do their jobs, make decisions, not have to try to comply with the bureaucratic dictates.
Well, yeah, it gives everybody more freedom to adapt to the particular situation. But key to this is being able to hold government officials accountable. If somebody abuses their power, if they're a jerk, they ought to be able to be fired. And I just got a call from the White House recently asking me if I could help come up with a complete overhaul of that system of public employment, which I've written a lot about. And that's absolutely critical to this idea of pushing the reset button.
So is the problem tied to the people involved, or is it the system? I mean, if the people were given more flexibility, would we see better outcomes?
Well, it's both. I mean, the culture of government's awful now. I mean, Washington, I get a rash whenever I go over the bridge from the airport. You know, it's just a horrible place. I mean, people – they wouldn't take they wouldn't know what responsibility was. I mean, one of the things I suggest in my new book, Try Common Sense, is that we move most agencies out of Washington and move them around the country. So, you know, we could move the Department of Transportation to North Carolina Right. You know, I mean, you know, why not? It would work better. The Centers for Disease Control is in Atlanta. It works better than the agencies in Washington. But for democracy to work, you need to let the people who are elected make new choices. And that includes choices about who's implementing the law. And right now, all the links in that chain are broken. And one of the points that I make that people just don't understand, the cure to red tape is responsibility and accountability. You don't need all this red tape. You don't need to spend 5 years on a permit. If you let people use their judgment and be accountable if they do a bad job, if they're on the take or something, you know, so the only way to actually alleviate the frustration and the alienation, I mean, law is piled up so much that everybody's now trained to go through the day saying, can I prove what I'm about to do is legally correct? You know, businesses don't give job references and teachers won't put an arm around a crying child. It's madness.
We are chatting with Philip Howard. He is the author of the book Try Common Sense. Do you get a sense that the people who are working in government now want that responsibility and accountability, or do they like this system where they can write their way out of responsibility by making sure they just check the boxes?
Responsibility is their worst nightmare. They absolutely don't want responsibility. And the only way to make them take responsibility is to fire them if they don't. I mean, you know, there are, frankly, if you look at anything that works, and not everything in government's broken, you know, you can find agencies where people do a good job and such. And if you look in those agencies or go to any public school that works well, you'll find people who wake up in the morning saying, I'm going to go make sense of these choices and make this work. So there are, you know, nothing works unless a person makes it work. In the history of civilization, nothing ever got accomplished because somebody followed a rule. Rules are there to prevent bad things from happening. They don't make good things happen. And so, that's one of the reasons I think we should move the agencies out of Washington. We need new people.
I understand that one of your arguments is that we have reached the political state that we have now largely because people have been so fed up with this system that one of the things that attracted them to Donald Trump was he wanted to come in and wreck the bad system.
Sure. I mean, Donald Trump's just a symptom of this extraordinary alienation from government by the American people. They hate it. And yet, if you look at the candidates, if you look at all the Democratic candidates today, you can't find one who has any idea about how to make government work better. They're talking about socialism or Medicare for All or the Green New Deal or something like that. They're not talking about actually making government responsive. And if you go to the Trump administration, they have the kind of right instinct about, you know, fixing government, but they don't – their only idea is sort of deregulation, which is good in some areas. I mean, some things we shouldn't be regulating. But it's not the cure for red tape. The cure for red tape is responsibility and accountability. And so there are lots of things that people want clean water and clean air, but it shouldn't drive people nuts. You know, you shouldn't have inspectors giving fines to farmers because there's insignificant runoff.
You've been watching this for years. You've been writing about it since the 1990s. How convinced are you that at some point we are going to take these steps to re-inject common sense into the system?
Oh, great question. I can't make change. You can't make change. Change is happening. Donald Trump is a symptom of change. Washington might as well be the court of Louis XVI. It's collapsing. I mean, people hate it. So it's going to change. But look at where the needle is going. Look at where the left is going, the lunacy. What's needed is a radical centrist platform. The force of the change will come from the people. What I'm worried about is that there's no coherent vision of what the change ought to be. And what I'm preaching, if you will, is a system that gives back to humans the freedom to take responsibility. And where law is a framework for freedom, it's not an instruction manual that tells us how to live our lives correctly. It's just absurd.
Well, if you want to get a first step toward that path toward more freedom, the book is titled Try Common Sense. Its author is Philip Howard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice being with you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state legislators want to step up laws against criminal gangs. Republican State Representative Ted Davis of New Hanover County explains.
There's a real problem with gangs, not only in New Hanover County, but throughout the state. We developed House Bill 633, which will revise the Criminal Gang Nuisance Abatement Act. It'll revise the Criminal Gang Suppression Act. It'll increase penalties for use of a firearm in gang criminal activity or a felony, increase the penalty for possession of a firearm by a felon in some instances, and create a new evidentiary rule regarding evidence of criminal gang activity.
Democratic State Representative Marsha Morey of Durham County questioned one provision of the bill.
A gang member is identified by attitudes, behaviors, demeanors, without a charge of criminal activity. Because they say they're in a gang or they throw a gang sign without any criminal activity, they're then designated a gang member and this statute could be used against them.
The statute claims that a criminal gang is a public nuisance. So they have to find the gang is the nuisance, but if they do, the gang members can be subject to the injunction against the activity.
Republican Representative John Faircloth of Guilford County explained why he thinks tougher laws make sense.
Just want to point out to particularly those of us who have been in law enforcement for the past 30 or 40 years, as this gang thing has developed over time in our state, we've all learned a lot. We went into this not really knowing what a gang was. It was something we saw in a movie back in the 50s where somebody threw an eraser against a blackboard and made a teacher mad. Gangs are real. They are ingrained in North Carolina as they are other states. And as we go through our experiences between law enforcement and these gangs, we're learning more and more, and this is just one more step in the progress we're making in coping with these gangs. They have not been defeated. They're doing a lot of danger. They're hurting a lot of people, and we need to work together with this, and that's what this latest tool is. And I think we will find that the general public is behind this, no matter where you live in town, no matter where you work, no matter the color of your skin. There are people out there in gangs who will hurt you.
That's Representative John Faircloth, a former police chief and a supporter of stronger gang laws for North Carolina. The idea needs support from the State House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you've ever accepted a phone call from a local number, only to learn that it's really a telemarketer or scam artist, you might be interested in an idea moving through the North Carolina General Assembly. It's an idea that started with State House Speaker Tim Moore. He's a Republican from Cleveland County. Moore took the rare step of speaking from the House floor about his bill.
When I was out campaigning like all of us this last year, you would wonder what kinds of things would folks ask a member of the House or the Speaker of the House about when they're out talking to you here and there. And believe it or not, this issue came up more than anything else. I know we spend a lot of time talking about everything here, from the budget to Medicaid, to you name it. I heard more about this issue than anything else this year and discovered how bad of a problem it is in terms of these spoofing phone calls and these text messages. And it's a real problem. And so for most of it, it's an annoyance. It's a nuisance. You hang up the phone, you go on. But for some people, they actually get duped and lose a lot of money. They may get a call, and it may even be their number, or it could be the number of a family member or a loved one. And so they get a call, and they think, oh, this is so-and-so calling. And it turns out it's somebody trying to get money from them. And you've all probably seen things online of these scams that people do where they'll get them to give up their credit card numbers or information to do things and steal from them. So that's already against the law. But there's actually some who, even under lawful services, will try to use this spoofing technique on the number to make it look like it's a local call.
Moore doesn't like that deception. That's why he drafted legislation to address the issue.
My belief is, and what this bill does, basically says that is an unfair and deceptive trade practice if you do that. And if you do that, you can be sued, you can be held liable, you can be held liable for attorney's fees, treble damages, all those things under Chapter 75. That's what this bill does. It'll protect our North Carolina citizens and consumers.
Moore's idea attracted support from his colleagues in the State House. Republican Chris Humphrey represents Lenoir County.
Obviously, it's going to regulate telephone solicitations made through text communications as well.
Republican Dana Bumgardner of Gadsden County added his support to the measure.
I tell you, anybody who's ever gotten a call, a sales call late at night from the Philippines, from your own phone number, They know what this is about, and so I absolutely support this, and I wish I had thought of it.
Democratic Representative Verla Insko had some questions about how the bill would work. Insko addressed those questions to the State House Speaker.
I'm curious about how this works. I mean, what do I do? Are you think this bill is going to scare these people?
A couple of ways. One, you would have a private right of action that you could bring, but you also could report it to the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General's office, through its civil enforcement, would now have the opportunity to get at treble damages and punitive damages. That's the biggest thing. It's not perfect because part of the problem is if you're getting a call from offshore, there are some real challenges to enforcement on that because how are you going to get that person? And what I can tell you is that the feds are also working with this at the Federal Communications Commission, and this is something they're working with, particularly when it comes to offshore violations.
So am I supposed to look at the screen and copy the number down and report that to the Attorney General? I mean, what do I do as a person who gets a lot of these calls?
It would be, you would get that, and then, of course, the carriers, through the subpoena power of the Attorney General's office or through, frankly, a private right of action, you could get at where that number came from. There are ways to track that electronically. So it may show, for example, Representative Insko, your home number, but it actually came from another. They actually have the capability to show where the call actually originated from.
Republican Jason Sane of Lincoln County offered his colleagues some national perspective on the issue.
Like Representative Bumgarner, I wish I'd thought of it first, but luckily I was standing there beside the speaker when he did think of it, and he asked me to be on the bill with him. As the speaker alluded to, I serve on the Intergovernmental Advisory Committee for the FCC, and we're not the only state, as you might imagine, that's struggling with this. And all are trying to find ways to combat this. Citizens are tired of it. I know I'm tired of it at my house and where I get it on my phone, my wife get it on her phone, the calls to the house and everything else. So this is not a silver bullet, but it does give us a starting point. Citizens should be, should know who's calling them, should be something that we can, decipher and not have some of our oldest and youngest among us played upon, and as you hear about scams that come across.
Sane told colleagues that this bill might represent just a first step in addressing telephone number spoofing scams.
We're going to watch this legislation, see how, once implemented, once it passes, how this will work, and if it is a solution or if there's more to be done. He's doing some research and working with me on that and with some of the telecom companies and others to make sure that we get to this problem. So this may not be the final part of what you hear. It's a good starting point, and we'll certainly work to perfect this as hopefully this diminishes. But it's something that really all states are struggling with, and I appreciate the bipartisan support for our effort.
Democrat Greg Meyer of Orange County supports the measure. He suggested other ideas for the General Assembly to pursue.
I agree it's an important problem, and it's a step in the right direction. As Representative Sane just mentioned, we were looking at kind of what might the next steps be, and we know in the legislative process we have to take things sometimes one step at a time. I'm raising, actually not so much to speak to the body, but to make sure that the telecoms who are out there listening to this important bill to them understand how important this is to the people of North Carolina, and that this bill approaches trying to go after the people that are perpetrating the calls. But in order to do that, we're going to need the telecoms participation. And so we need to work with them to figure out the way that they can use their best technology to trap these numbers and stop these numbers so that you don't get harassed as a consumer. And hopefully this helps us go in the right direction. We can work with them. If we need to come back and look at more, we'll do that in the future.
Republican Michael Speciale often bucks legislative leaders, but in this case, he offered full-throated support of State House Speaker Tim Moore's proposal on phone number spoofing.
I want to thank the speaker for coming up with this bill. Of course, I know it's probably easy for him with all the time standing up there. You got a lot of time to think, figure these things out. But it's very annoying, very annoying. I went to answer the phone one time, and I looked, and it was my phone number. So you can imagine when I answered it and realized it wasn't me, how surprised I was. question, somebody had asked a question about, if the number's a spoof, well, what number do you give them? You just give them what you've got, and you give them the date and the time, and they can figure out the date and the time where that phone call came from. I think it's a great idea. And I think it's past due.
The bill even generated some lighthearted debate. Democratic Representative Elmer Floyd of Cumberland County lobbed a question at the State House Speaker.
Representative Moore, I support your bill, but I've gotten so many of these calls that I thought I was important. So I just want to know, is this going to make me less important?
Representative Floyd, you are very important, sir.
In the end, the measure attracted overwhelming support in the House.
The clerk will lock the machine and record the vote with 113 voting in the affirmative and none in the negative. House Bill 724 has passed its second reading and will, without objection, be read a third time.
The vote on the third and final reading was also unanimous. The measure needs support from the state Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A new professional pathway is emerging in the dental field with the goal of addressing North Carolina's shortage of dentists and thus limited access to primary and restorative dental care services. Now, this afflicts particularly areas of our state that are more rural, as well as some of our more vulnerable populations. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He has just released an analysis that he co-wrote on the subject of dental therapy and dental therapists in North Carolina. Jordan joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, so tell us first about this dental care shortage in our state.
Well, as many of the listeners may know, we have a very rural population, one of the biggest in the country. And in these rural parts of the state, there tends to be a real lack of health professionals, and that includes primary care providers, mental health professionals, and especially dental professionals. And so data shows that out of North Carolina's 100 counties, 74 of those counties don't have an adequate number of dental professionals to serve the nearby population. So folks in these places, the more rural parts of the country or state, really have a tough time accessing care.
Which is why there is an effort underway, and you are one of the researchers and analysts that's been looking at this. So what can we do? What are the options for trying to make sure that people do have access to this type of care? And the field that has emerged is in a couple of other states mm-hmm. is called dental therapy, and the people who engage in this are called dental therapists. So tell us what that means.
So despite what the name means, there's no psychologists or psychiatrists right. involved in dental therapy. So these are mid-level dental practitioners. They're highly educated and highly trained professionals. Think of a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. So they can't quite do all the things that the dentist can do, but they have a wide scope and more than a dental hygienist. And they, in other states that they've been allowed to practice in, the benefits have been great. They tend to serve underserved populations because they, when the regulations around the profession are very flexible, they can have what's called a general supervision contract with the dentist, which allows them to travel outside of the dentist's office and serve the populations that they want to.
So these are educated folks. They're not just people who want to try to help people in general. I mean, they have specific skills, not the skills to the level of a full dentist, but they know how to do certain things. Like what?
Well, they specialize in preventative and restorative care, you know, taking care of your teeth. They can do some other things like fillings and, you know.
a lot of things that people routinely need to have done, but which doesn't necessarily require the time of someone who is certified as a full dentist.
Right. And so when dentists can have these professionals in their practices, they can utilize them at a higher rate to offer these preventive and restorative procedures, and then dentists can focus more on the highly complex procedures. So there's benefits throughout the whole spectrum of the dentist practice.
So, Jordan, why is it then that in North Carolina we have not seen this field and these specialists?
Well, just like with a lot of other public policies, that we don't have regulations in place that allow the practice of dental therapy. So in order to bring that here to North Carolina, what we would need to do, folks down at the General Assembly would have to pass some legislation that would amend a part of the North Carolina General Statutes, and it would grant the North Carolina Dental Board of Examiners power to issue and oversee these professionals, issue licenses and oversee these professionals, and basically create a new designation of dental health professional and, you know, lay out what they're allowed to do, and that's the process.
And so that's kind of the legal and regulatory side mm-hmm. of it. And then let's say that that were to occur and that I decided I want to become a dental therapist, mm-hmm. I'd have to probably go to school somewhere.
That's right. So there's, you know, it's this process would take time. So we'd have to pass legislation. We'd have to, you know, lay out the guidelines, the regulatory framework, and then educational institutions would have to create a curriculum, and then they get accredited by a the dental association that oversees the education. And once, you know, different states have different requirements for how much education, but generally it's around 2 years of education that you can go to, and, you know, different levels of degrees. But, you know, once we get the educational curriculum in place and it gets accredited and people go through, then we would see the delivery phase, the on-the-ground practice of these professionals begin.
And in your new Spotlight report, which, by the way, is available at johnlock.org, and you can just search for the phrase dental therapy and you'll find Jordan Roberts' report right there. You lay out the fact that other states, several of them, are now leading the way. Mm-hmm. Minnesota and Alaska are into this, and it would take time for North Carolina to do this, but if you start the process, then you can do that.
That's right.
It would take time, but there would be definite benefits.
Absolutely.
And you lay this out in the report really well. Talk to us a bit about the kinds of people or maybe the areas of the state that would benefit.
Yeah. So like I said before, if the supervision requirements are set up to allow these professionals, you know, flexible operating ability, they have the ability to go out and, you know, visit rural centers, schools, nursing facilities, so they can really address the dental needs of the populations we talk about in the report are the more rural areas, lower income.
So you're talking about seniors?
Seniors and, you know, the people that really could benefit from just having more access to preventive and restorative care that they just aren't getting served right now. And so what we've seen in Alaska, where this profession really got started, was the American Indian population. They are the primary recipients of the benefits of this profession in Alaska, and the benefits have been well documented and tremendous: increased access, lower wait times, better overall health outcomes. And then in Minnesota, what the studies have found is that at observed clinics in this one study, they treated 6,000 new patients, and 84% of them had public insurance, meaning Medicare, Medicaid. And so for North Carolina, with 2 million Medicaid recipients and just half of Medicaid recipients who are under 21 received some form of dental visit in 2017, they could really benefit from increasing the number of practitioners that serve these populations.
That's an interesting point that you make in the report about the Medicaid population. We have, what, several million people in North Carolina?
Yes, just over 2 million.
Who receive their health insurance through the publicly funded program, Medicaid. And yet, while they do have a dental benefit, there's a huge percentage of those people on Medicaid who never do see a dentist for all sorts of reasons that you you go through in the report, but perhaps if there were practitioners that could, dental therapists who could go to them,
right,
or simply increase the supply of the mm-hmm. number of people who are able to provide this type of necessary work, more people could actually benefit.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we find is North Carolina's the amount of dentists in North Carolina that participate in Medicaid was far below the national average. And so when dentist's office can bring on these, you know, lower cost personnel to increase the volume, then, you know, they may see a newfound benefit in treating Medicaid patients when there's the demand for that in their area. So, like you said, just increasing the supply here is the goal, and, you know, letting the market forces work and, you know, bringing the benefits to these populations.
What I love about this idea, Jordan, is that it seems like it is a no-brainer, so to speak, mm-hmm. that folks, no matter your ideology, whether it's left, center, or right, you should be able to agree, one would think, that allowing this to come into North Carolina, making the statutory changes, getting the education in place, that this would really help folks. It would be a big benefit to so many people in our state.
Absolutely.
Jordan, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.